I will call the meeting to order. Do we have a quorum?
No.
No, all right. Dr. Melcher, I guess we'll start with you, since the Department of Revenue is not here yet, or are they? No.
Revenue, Beth Cadoon.
Welcome. And members, we have the governor's charter school property tax exemption before us. It's part of another bill, House File 3306, Article 6, Section 2. And all we have is the one page. They decided not to cut down trees, just to give us this one little section. That's page 70 of this bill. And so we are just here so we can comment on it. This is Representative Downey's bill, and the Department of Revenue is here, so I'll let the two of you decide which one wants to start and tell us about this section.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. I'm here to speak regarding, obviously, the governor's supplemental budget proposal on charter schools. If I first could just give you a little bit of background regarding the issue, and then I'll explain what his proposal is. The Department of Revenue's role is to ensure that property tax laws are administered uniformly and properly around the state. It was brought to our attention a few months ago that there might be a little lack of clarity and consistency on the taxation of charter schools for property tax purposes. Excuse me, I was just ran in from the hall, so get my breath here. We did a survey of the counties to see how they were treating these charter schools around the state. What we found out in that survey is of the 172 charter school locations, that currently there were 77 that are being taxed for property tax purposes and then 95 that are exempt of these locations. What the current law states, and you can also see what the current law is in the section of the governor's bill that you do have in front of you. And what the current law would state for property tax purposes, let me get my notes here, is that property that is leased or rented to a school district is exempt from property tax from property tax if the school district has exclusive use of the property, provide direct instruction for a period of at least 12 consecutive months. And then the other requirement for property tax exemption is that the school district would pay a nominal consideration for the building in that lease or less. So that's current law. What we found in our survey is that really the current practice by assessors is that they're really looking at those properties. And if those charter schools are being leased from currently exempt properties, such as schools and churches, that they were then continuing that property tax exemption, and they weren't really looking at if the rent was nominal or not, which is, like I stated, the other requirement for a tax to be exempt. Department of Education can talk more about that, but our understanding from them, which is that really for the lease rent, that none of the charter schools are paying what would you consider nominal rent or less. And what that would mean is that really for property tax purposes, all of these charter schools should be taxed for property tax purposes. And like we said in our survey, we found out that that was not currently the case that was occurring. And because of that, we really suggested for the counties that they maybe would want to just kind of maintain the status quo, that we'd bring this issue back to the legislature to see if they wanted to retain current law or make some modifications to it. And so that's what you see in the governor's budget recommendation, is he recommended that we would just exempt all properties that are being leased from charter schools from property taxes. So that was the governor's recommendation. And I think in the governor's original budget recommendation that the amount that was carried, I don't know if you've gotten the update, that amount was then adjusted slightly. When you do this, it would actually be a net savings to the general fund, and Tom can talk about the lease aid interaction, but part of that is then it would be a reduction in lease aid payments to the charter schools, And then the other part is when you then exempt properties, which would be removing $10.6 million from the prop tax rolls when you exempt all the charter schools. What that would do then, in effect, also then is, obviously, when you reduce one property tax, exempt one property tax, what that does is then shift taxes onto the other properties in that local jurisdiction. There's then an interaction with occurs, then we assume there's then going to be some increase in property tax refunds for individuals. And then the other interaction is with our individual income tax system, which you can itemize your property taxes, and that then would show as a net reduction also in individual income tax receipts. But the bottom line for the governor's proposal to exempt all charter schools would be a net state impact to the positive for fiscal year 11 of $440,000. And then fiscal year 12, it's $75,000 is the net, and 13 is $361,000.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. And in administering the charter school lease aid formula, reviewing leases and so forth, we noticed that there were some charter schools that were including property tax payments that they were making as part of their lease, and some that weren't. And so we did kind of initiate a follow-up with the Department of Revenue to determine what the proper way was of doing that. And the Department of Revenue attorneys, and looking at the statute, determined that essentially, given the fact that none of the charter schools are paying a nominal amount, they're all paying pretty much market rates, that they all should be taxable. And since roughly half of them were and half of them weren't, under the current practice, there was an effort to try to make a consistent treatment. And so for the February forecast now, we have built the forecast for charter school lease aid for the future, assuming that they all would be taxable, and that there would be some increase in lease cost associated with landlords raising rents to cover these higher taxes. Our assumption for purposes of the forecast, and also for purposes of the governor's bill, was that there would be kind of a 50-50 split, where sometimes the lease cost would go up, sometimes they wouldn't, or vice versa. And that's the basis for the savings that you see in the governor's proposal, is that we're assuming that there would be some either reduction in lease cost as a result of property currently being taxed that would no longer be taxable, or property that would otherwise under current law be going from not taxed to being taxed, but that wouldn't happen. And so the net bottom line is a reduction in lease aid as a result of charter schools paying less rent because of lower taxes.
All right. Before we go to questions, I think I will now have Mr. Strom explain the handouts that are in our packet that pertain to this discussion. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, the Departments of Revenue and Education were kind enough to share their spreadsheets with us, and what you have in your packet is a reformatted spreadsheet listed in charter school numerical order, showing the charter school name, the city where that charter school is located, the owner of the property that the charter school is leasing, and the tax exempt the tax status of that property, as well as the reason for the tax exemption. And then the last several columns show the estimated fiscal year 10 lease amount. That's the first number that shows up there. So for City Academy, for example, their estimated lease is $60,000. The next column shows the pupil units, the number of children attending that charter school. The second to last column then is that lease amount per pupil. And then the last column shows the maximum lease amount that's allowed under state law. As members are probably aware, for nearly all charter schools, their maximum lease amount is in statute at either the lesser of 90% of their actual lease or $1,200 per pupil. And that $1,200 per pupil, 90%, that's 90% of 1,333. So essentially, the maximum amount for nearly all charter schools would be that $1,333 per pupil. So this information, as I said, is ordered by charter school number, and gives you some sense of the lease amounts that they're currently paying per pupil. And you can look down that list and see which properties are exempt and which are currently taxable.
All right, thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Ward.
Just a question to Mr. Strom on that. I noticed that some of the charters under the tax status are blank, either not exempt or not taxed. Is that, are they nonprofits, or can you explain why some of them have a blank under the tax status?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, could you point out a specific example? There are some charter schools that are
Pillager.
Listed. Okay, what number is that, Mr. Chair?
Representative
4080. Ward. Oh, excuse me, Pillager is tax. Wait a minute. There's another one that I in my district that I saw. I'll just pick one off. 4085.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Okay, so you're looking at 4045?
4085. 4085. 4084.
Okay, so on page 5 of the printout, I'm not sure. Oh, Madam Chair, the Assistant Commissioner can speak to this.
Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, for the survey that we did with the 87 counties, most of them did respond, but the ones you're seeing where we don't have any report were there were a couple counties that did not respond to the survey.
Thank you very much, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, members, just one thing I would like to point out. The tax status that's listed here is the current tax status for this most recent year. Under the budget forecast, we've assumed that all of those that are listed as exempt would become taxable because that's the way that the law reads. The county assessors haven't been in strict compliance with the law. So, for example, City Academy on the first page here currently has been tax exempt, but under the interpretation of the law, unless there's a law change, they would become taxable. So those would be the schools where there would be some change from the current status if they were not to have legislation of this type enacted.
And we've been, some of us have been aware of this problem, and I think it's good to get all the charter schools on the same footing. And so the question is this proposal and the way of doing it. And I'm just wondering why you decided to have for-profit landlords get tax-exempt status. And is there any other precedent for for-profit landlords getting tax-exempt status if they're leasing to any other type of leasee?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for what my understanding why the governor's recommendation was basically if it's just to treat, I guess, all schools more equally, that if there's a school properties being used by the school, that they should just be exempt. So that was the governor's recommendation. My understanding for other for-profits, if there's any, it's not, I don't believe with the shakeout Stephanie's had from the property tax division that there is any other for-profits that would be currently exempt for property tax purposes.
So this would be precedent setting in that regard. I'm just thinking of like the renter's credit. You know, we all, even though most of us, a lot of us here don't serve on the tax committee, we're pretty familiar with the renter's credit, and because that's something our constituents contact us about. And I think there's good reason that the renter's credit goes to the renters and not the landlord, because they don't always pass it along. And I'm noticing, Dr. Melcher just said, we're assuming half of them will pass it along and half of them will pocket it. And I'm just kind of concerned about that, because aren't we trying to get the charter schools on the same footing? And if they don't get their rent consistently reduced due to their tax-exempt status, how does that put the charter schools on the same footing? Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, this kind of 50-50 assumption was just kind of a guess on the aggregate. It involves kind of a back of the envelope analysis, but part of this is, for example, you've got City Academy, Bluffview Montessori, New Heights on the first page, for example. Right now those are not being taxed. We've assumed that next year they would be taxed, and that so for purposes of the budget forecast, we've increased the lease costs for all of those schools by an estimated amount of property tax. And then we've assumed that half of that would be coming off in the event that the bill was changed and they were made non-exempt, which basically puts them back where they're at today for those particular schools. So it's not so some of this is assuming that, you know, will the City of St. Paul increase the lease cost to the City Academy if the law isn't changed? So it's kind of a curious mix of assumptions that get made here, and it's just kind of the best estimate we could make. We're not positive how the landlords will treat the situation in situations where they're currently exempt and they would otherwise become taxable. Will they always increase the rent? We don't know. And by the same token, we're not sure if there are currently entities that are being taxed, if the taxes are lowered, will they in every case lower the rent? Those are based on individual negotiations that occur in each particular charter school, and we just don't have a scientific basis of looking at each of those individually, and so we just used kind of a global assumption that in aggregate it would be about 50%.
And Dr. Melcher, while we're busy making things equal for the various charter schools, would this also apply to a regular school district, or would they have to pay? Would they have an uneven playing field compared to charter schools?
Madam Chair and members, if a regular school district is leasing a property to a charter school, currently they are generally exempt, but if there's no change in law, they would have to pay the tax, and then they'd have to decide if they wanted to pass the cost onto the charter school.
But Dr. Melcher, I was thinking if a district were renting for themselves, which occasionally due to circumstances they do.
If a school district is renting a building themselves, I'm not responsible for tax policy.
Are they treated differently and than I would say unfairly compared to charter schools?
I am not certain. Mr. Sturica here.
Madam Chair, could have Lance Sturica, okay, who's with our legal department at the property tax.
Sturica, okay. Welcome, Mr. Sturica.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Lance Sturica with the Department of Revenue. If I understand the question correctly, if a non-charter school was renting property from a private landlord, and that rent was not nominal, the school that property would be taxable, even with this change.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, my understanding is property tax classifications were based on the use of the property. So can you explain how that would make that I guess I'm confused as to why that would they be paying taxes on that?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Representative, it would be with some trepidation that I would get into the basis for exemption on lots of different properties. But the answer to your question at its simplest is, I guess I'm not quite sure how to approach it. One example I use is I own property, I lease it to someone, and then they have a sublease. They sublet it. You got three uses going on. Which one is important? And those are the kind of questions we would look at. In the context of a building that's being leased by a private party to a school, the use of the property that we normally look at is the use by the owner. The owner is the one that has a choice. Do I want to use it this way or do I want to use it that way? The use that the tenant puts the property to is usually not relevant for the exemption. So it's the landlord's use of the property to generate income that would negate the exemption.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, members, we don't have this bill in our possession, so we can't amend it right here, which if this were in our possession, I would want to hold it and fix it. We have always heard from charter schools that if we would just exempt them from rules, that they could do things more cheaply. But it seems year after year they keep coming back asking for more money. And I have always been a charter school supporter, but I don't like the trend of constantly asking for more money, especially if it gets ahead of other public schools, and this bill does. And I don't think we want the charter schools to be treated equally, but is anyone here on taxes?
Yeah.
Hey, three of you. Well, let's try to see if we can work on something, some sort of amendment that you all could offer in the tax committee for consideration to make sure that all public schools, charter schools, and non-charter schools have the same deal. And I would also urge you to look at something like the renter's credit, because I don't like the idea that our very precious and scarce tax dollars would go to some for-profit landlord who wouldn't pass it along to the charter schools. What's the point of that? Isn't there some way the charter schools could get a renter's credit? They rent from a taxable property, but they get the credit. Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that the relevant language that you may be amending is actually on the bottom of page 70 of this same bill. So what they've done is added a second clause that relates to charter schools, and the existing language for school districts is on line 7025 through 7031 and so forth. So that's the language that you might be amending if you were to look at changing the rules as it relates to school districts.
Thank you. Commissioner Cadone.
Madam Chair, I would also just mention for the tax committee members, just a reminder, they did hear a bill, I believe it was yesterday, which was House File 3198, which is a Representative Dill bill that dealt with the charter schools, and he had another option of how you would proceed with modifying the charter school property tax status.
And Ms. Cadoon, did that solve any of the problems we're raising here today?
What Representative Dill's bill did would be to say if you're currently exempt, such as renting from a school district, church, etc., that you'd remain to be exempt. If you were renting from or leasing from a for-profit, then you would be taxed.
So it's a very different bill then. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and some clarifying questions, because I was not as aware until very recently that this issue is floating out there. The first question is perhaps for staff, perhaps for the Assistant Commissioner, looking at the spreadsheet. What's a seminary of learning? I love the phrase, but I've never heard it before.
Dr. Melcher or Commissioner Cadoon? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne. The response you're seeing for the reason for tax exemption is what was responded by from the county. Mm-hmm. So that was their reason that they gave of why they were doing the tax exemption. So I'm not sure what that phrase would necessarily mean. But it typically was when they seemed to be responding was, like I said, the typical practice seemed to be if it was a currently exempt property, such mm-hmm. as a church or, I guess, a seminary of learning that would be currently exempt, that they then treated it maintain that current property tax exemption.
That appears to be the language that Ramsey County used for a school.
Yeah. Madam Chair, it strikes me as a charming, archaic phrase. I'm looking at page 71, lines 13 to 17, and I'm assuming that the language relating to the lease and exclusive right to use the property down on 7116 only applies to the space within the building that the charter school is leasing. I'm thinking of the German Immersion School in St. Paul at a seminary of learning then, but that rents within a larger building that has multiple offices of various entities in it. And I'm just needing some clarification and assurance.
Commissioner
Cadoon. Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, that's our understanding as well.
And Madam Chair, one last question. When this issue was raised to me very recently by a GOP member of the Tax Committee, it was paired with, let's give charter schools tax exemption so that they are taxed appropriately. But it was matched with, and then we can reduce lease aid because they will have lower costs. And then we can book those savings and we can spend that elsewhere. So I'm struck that I'm not hearing that from the department now and not hearing that from the governor's office. And can either of the departments that are there respond?
Dr. Melton.
Madam Chairman, Representative Dabney, on the governor's budget pages, and I think you've got a copy of those in your packet, they are carrying a a savings of $440,000 in fiscal 11 and $535,000 in fiscal 12, $831,000 in fiscal 13 for a reduction in lease aid as a result of the lease, the charter school's property being exempted.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I was looking at the bill and not seeing it and not looking at the other.
Yeah, changing the forecast, but we would be caring for the lease aid account.
Okay. All right.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And what are other states doing? Maybe, I don't think this was answered yet, but around us, do they have any policies like this, other states?
Commissioner Cadoon.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not aware. We didn't survey other states, and I'm not aware of how they treat charter schools for property tax purposes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just 2 points. One is the one that Dr. Melcher made, that this is actually booked as a savings to the state of Minnesota and expenditures. But the second thing, and I'm channeling the chairman of the property tax division here, Representative Marquardt, in saying that if we do a credit, please keep in mind that that is going to be an expenditure in the tax budget. So it's actually going to count as money. It's going to be a line item, whereas this exemption for property tax purposes, it's not a tax cut. We're just shifting who's paying taxes. So that might be, again, not to turn this into the tax committee, but the that would be one reason why what might be easier to be having the way this exclusion is designed is to book it as an expenditure savings by shifting existing property tax burden as opposed to putting that expenditure out there. And maybe the chairman of the property tax division could kind of back that up.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. I'm glad the chairman of the property tax commission or committee is here, and wish he'd been here for the whole thing because this is very important. And you may very well be right, Representative Garofalo, you know, but because if it were a credit, then that would impact the savings. But right now, the savings that we're getting here at the state level is shifting, you know, like we like to do. It's just costing somebody something, and it's local property taxpayers as usual. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Melcher, just to clarify a question, your answer to a question that Representative Dabney asked. The savings to the state that is being booked, you're saying, is as a result of lower lease aid. But isn't that making the assumption, as the chair pointed out, that these for-profit organizations will turn around and reduce that lease aid, and yet there's no mechanism in here for that? I guess the question would be, if we put that mechanism in the bill, would there be a greater savings? You would no longer be looking at a 50-50. It would be mandatory. I guess I'm just curious about your comment on that idea.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative, I would say it's a combination of for-profit and non-profit and school districts and all of the various entities that are leasing to charter schools. Yes, the assumption currently is that they would all be taxable, and this would make them all non-taxable, whether they're for-profit churches, et cetera. And we're saying on the average, and we're not trying to identify, or we don't have enough data to really know whether the school districts would treat that are landlords would treat the property or the rates differently than the for-profits would. We're just saying on average we think about half of that would result in lower lease charges, and about half of it might be somehow retained by the landlord. And I imagine if you had some language that would cause that to go down in all cases, and I think it might be hard to enforce or figure out exactly how to make that work, that could result in some additional savings.
Our staff, Brad Kelly, has just provided me with a copy of a bill from 2006 that addressed the same issue, and the bill didn't go anywhere. But it had a provision in here that he has highlighted that I think might be helpful here. So thank you, Mr. Kelly. It says the landlord getting this tax-exempt status shall provide the board of the charter school documentation of the landlord's expenses to ensure that the savings from the property tax exemption under this paragraph are realized by the charter school. So, you know, that may be language that in Representative Marquardt's committee that could be added to this bill to make sure that somebody isn't making a fast profit, you know, instead of us. if we have this. And then the other thing I would ask you to look at is putting charter schools and regular schools on the same basis. I don't know if you were here for that, Representative Marquardt, but we just found out that this gives an advantage to charter schools but not to regular public schools if they should be leasing property, and we certainly wouldn't want to do that. The whole premise of this bill is to treat one charter school the same as another, so I don't think at the same time we want to give an advantage to all charter schools compared to all regular public schools. So if you could, I'll give this language to Representative Marquardt, and then if you could work on the other, and we will ask our staff to follow what you're doing and offer assistance. Anybody else wish to testify on this bill? I have Mr. Piccolo on the list. Welcome, Mr. Piccolo.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Just a couple brief comments. First, we support the concept behind this bill. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. For a couple reasons. One is when you look at charter schools that are leasing from cities and school districts, basically all we are doing is shifting state money to local governments. And so we don't see that that benefits any particular way of doing things. In terms of those who lease from nonprofits, I think one of the things we've seen in the last year since the letter from the Department of Revenue about a year ago is a number of counties actually putting on a tax on schools and the nonprofits they lease from. So this has been something that has occurred dramatically changed in the last year. And so we would encourage that for nonprofits, that charter schools, at least for nonprofits, that they be exempt. In terms of for-profit landlords, we don't have a position. We believe that everybody should be treated the fair and the same in terms of for-profit. So we support the concept behind this bill. We support getting rid of just transfer of money between government levels and support the nonprofits maintaining tax-exempt status.
Thank you very much. Any other testimony? Representative Anselms?
Whether you are creating, as an example, a tax increment financing district, or in the case of that slice of the 150 charter schools, you are creating an exemption not currently enjoyed by those charter schools. The real shift here is from one taxpayer to another class of taxpayers. And I'm okay with that in the case of charters, but I don't know that those decisions should be made here. Shouldn't those decisions be made at the local level in those cases where charters are currently paying property taxes? Because that's the shift that's going to be real interesting to discuss.
And Representative Hells, that's kind of what's happening now. Some county assessors are making them exempt, and some are taxing them, and so we're back to where we started with trying to get some uniformity here. But if we do nothing, that would be the question. What would the county assessors do? Would they keep being spotty on it, or would they all leap to taxing now that they're more perhaps aware of this?
Well, I would suggest that be a local decision.
So you would speak against the bill and let it be locally decided. So there's some more input for the tax committee.
No. Writing that down.
Okay. All right. Any other comments before we move on? Representative Biscuits. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Would you also then leave to a local decision whether or not they tax traditional public schools?
Representative Anselms, quickly, because I think we're going to move
absolutely
on.
Not.
All right, that's it. We're done with this, and now we do have a quorum, and so we will approve the minutes from yesterday, and I will note as well that when Representative Anselms' bill was before us, We actually, it was a bill like this. We did not have it in our possession, and I moved it, and we passed it along to wherever. So we've gotten legal authority from House staff to say, just make the minutes right and forget what we did yesterday. And Representative Van Zels is okay with that. And he would actually like it to be entertained for the omnibus bill. So if we had had it in our possession, we would have laid it over for possible inclusion. So with that, Representative Mariani, would you like to move the minutes?
I would do so.
Okay. Representative Mariani moves the minutes of March 24th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And now we spend the rest of the time on Representative Mariani's high school assessments bill that those of us who serve on policy have heard quite a bit about, but some of us don't. So you're going to have to hear quite a bit more. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I appreciate you warming me up by encouraging me to move the minutes here. I'm warmed up. Madam Chair, do you want a motion at this point to
Yes.
before us?
Yep.
So, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 3421 the motion be considered to for adoption in the inclusion in the omnibus K-12 finance bill.
So Representative Mariani moves House File 3421 for possible inclusion. Representative Mariani, and I understand you have an amendment. Do you want to do that first?
Yeah, yes, Madam Chair. I would move the A-28 amendment.
Representative Mariani moves the A-28 amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, members, there's nothing really that I'm doing here with this amendment new. It's basically two things. It's cleaning up some grammatical language as we move the bill out of the policy committee last Thursday. There's some grammar errors that we want to clear up in the first couple lines here. And then the other part has to do with an issue, has to do with getting the right language in terms of students who transfer from other states in terms of meeting these new requirements in our new assessment system. And the language that we have before us reflects the intent of the policy committee at the time. We were moving awfully quickly on Thursday night, and so we didn't quite capture some of the things that we had intended to capture. This language matches the Department of Education's recommendations at that time, which we, even though I had resisted initially, I thought better of it and deduced that they were correct. And so this language just lines up the actions of the committee that evening.
Very good. And Representative Garofalo, I noticed that the amendment is 4 minutes out of order. Do you want to... It's fine, 9:23, and it's only 9:14. I'm just joking. Is it too much for Ms. Patrick?
Madam Chair, perhaps you should ask Ms. Patrick if it's okay. No, I'm fine with it, Madam Chair. Thank you. We're just joking about it down here.
So, anyway, any discussion on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mariani, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What I'd like to do is, since this committee has not had an opportunity to spend as much time as I subjected my committee to over the course of the last couple of months, is just to maybe slow down just a little bit, not to get into deep detail, but just to point out what the main thrust and the main elements of the bill is before us. And so what I'd like to do is just do a very, very brief background, talk about the bill's elements. There is a fiscal note to the original bill as introduced, and I think it's the committee obviously wants to spend time talking more in depth about those issues, so I want to offer a few comments on that, and then I would recommend, Madam Chair, that we hear briefly from Kent Pacow, who is one of the co-chairs of the task force, just to briefly tell us what the logic. I can try to do that, but I'll focus more on the elements of the bill, and I think it would be good to hear from a third party about what the overall logic of the proposal is, and then I think it's appropriate, Madam Chair, to have the department comment on their fiscal note and anything else that they wish to comment on it.
Very good.
Madam Chair, in 2009, the legislature put off the math grad high school requirement several years while we undertook a reexamination of how to design a better assessment approach, one that would include less dependency on the use of only one measure, a single test, to determine the proficiency of students in math. We asked the Commissioner of Education to pull together, so what's before you is sort of part two of part one last year when we put off that math grad test, and we promised the state of Minnesota that we would not just put that off and let it hang out there, but that we would do the roll up our sleeves and do the hard work of seeing if there's a better way to do a better assessment in math in particular. And so we asked the Commissioner of Education to put together a task force of educators and community members to design recommendations for this legislative session to consider as a replacement for the math grad test. The task force was led by Dr. Dirk Mattson of the department and Mr. Ken Pickell of the University of Minnesota, and it engaged scores of Minnesotans throughout the interim in a very transparent and, quite frankly, very rigorous process. I participated in the task force discussions, and we had countless meetings, long hours, a lot of complicated stuff, a lot of very good, rigorous discussions, really testing out some of the basic assumptions around what a quality assessment system would look like, and looking at sort of, you know, new thoughts out in the field about how to do that effectively. I think that the task force, and it echoes my own values here, for the most part, came down on the side of it's very important to have quality assessments, a quality measurement approach and tools before us in order to have a good sense, a good measurement of outcomes. But in the process, we should also be about not just measuring the outcome, but having that system contribute to advancing the learning in our K-12 schools. The end result of the task force's work was a series of recommendations that are captured in the access report that I think all the members have in their packets: achieving college and career readiness for every student's success, and therefore access. Many of the access recommendations, not all, but many of them are captured in this bill. The legislation required the commissioner to forward his or her recommendations directly to us, not the task force, and so the commissioner did that in the form of the bill introduction of 3421. I authored the bill. We then, in policy, amended the bill largely to add some of the dimensions that were not initially put forward from the task force's recommendations. Members, we spent at least five hearings diving into this issue over the course of the last several months, starting with just very overall discussions about what the field tells us about assessments, hearing directly from the task force, hearing the commissioner's bill, and then at least two hearings amending and further adopting further amending the commissioner's proposals. The bill then, members, and I'll do this very quickly in terms of key elements, the bill authorizes an end of 10th grade exam for reading and writing, so a comprehensive test for English language arts, but in one test, however, with independent scores for each of the content areas, so for reading and writing. It authorizes end-of-course exams for algebra and biology that will comprise 25% of a student's overall course grade. So in other words, the end-of-course logic is one where you're basically using multiple measures. You're utilizing a uniform test that in combination, and this is a critically important point, you know, that there's some synergy that we're trying to create here in terms of forwarding that notion of both of having better measurements that also drive better learning. So the idea is to have the synergy between the performance on the test and performance and the other measures that the teacher, the instructor, would grade a student's work during their participation in the course. The exams themselves, in both cases, are tied to college and career readiness indicators, and that's another shift, members, and it's part of, you know, I guess a national shift that you're hearing in other states and also on the federal level of increasingly expecting K-12 outcomes to have relevancy in the area of work and post-secondary pursuits. The exams will include multiple choice and open-ended items and be designed for for computer administration and scoring. And then there's a novel idea in many ways here. We're introducing the concept of an alignment index. This came forward from the task force and the commissioner as well. An alignment index is authorized to safeguard against grade inflation relative to performance on the end of course exam. The concern being that that teachers might somehow blow off, you know, how the student performed on exam by overinflating their other 75% passing requirements in the course, and then forward students somehow with minimal knowledge. There's certainly, I would argue, actually, I'm being a little flippant, but I think, you know, there certainly has been evidence across the nation of instances where that has happened, where we've had end of course frameworks. And so to safeguard against that, we create something called an alignment index, which would, based on data analysis over a period of time, create a metric by which the state can ascertain whether or not grade inflation is happening, and more importantly, be about a process by which instructors understand the need to have a proper alignment and balance between performance on the exam and their grading practices. And so I would argue that it creates a very powerful dynamic in terms of ownership of teachers who, after all, are the most important in-school variable that leads to academic success. So I think this is a really exciting concept in that it really drives accountability, but it also, I think, really evokes and draws teachers much more fully into ownership of the accountability system, not just as a measuring tool, but also as a tool that can drive greater outcomes for students. The bill then does have another concept here, which is that the concept is that, you know, the stakes shouldn't just be borne by the students, which is what we were struggling with last year in regards to the math grad. It requires that students that are highly misaligned relative to this grade inflation issue to three things. One, to notify parents of the misalignment, so transparency about that. Two, to use school district funds to correct the misalignment. So school districts would, to some degree, you know, be directed in terms of, you know, away from the flexibility that they have relative to those staff development dollars in order to focus on correcting the misalignment issue. And then three, to have the end of course exam now jump to 50% of the course grade until such time as they get back aligned, and then they're back to 25%. In order to support struggling students and improve instruction, the Minnesota Department of Education must provide schools, and so this is another critical component and one that has a direct bearing on the cost discussions that you'll have. The department is required under this bill to provide tools for schools to support struggling students and improve instruction, specifically to provide formative assessment benchmarks that align with the test. We've had lots of discussions here over the last couple of years about the wisdom and the power of formative assessment tools as real-time tools that can further instruction, and then provide an item bank available to teachers. Some of the final elements, and then I'll stop with this part, Madam Chair. The student's transcript must show the level of college and career readiness in these subject areas, and then an assessment advisory committee is established to develop recommendations for a couple of things here that we didn't feel comfortable just putting into statute at this point. One is to develop recommendations for alternative ways in which students can meet the reading, writing, algebra, biology requirements. Some of those alternative ways might be ACT, SAT, concurrent enrollment, AP, IB performance levels. And then the idea is that those recommendations come back to us for subsequent legislative approval. And then that assessment advisory committee is also required to develop recommendations for a state-level student appeal process to these new requirements. Madam Chair, just to add, just very quickly, obviously, there are cost issues related to any time you do, a new design here. And so there are going to be test development costs because we're going to be developing new tests over time here. There will certainly be some costs related to the development of the formative assessment tools that I mentioned. And then just to compound in an already complicated situation, we're going to have to go through a transition period of time where for several years we'll continue to have students participating in the grad test requirements while we're phasing in these end of course and this new comprehensive test. And that is going to beg some issues related to cost. The department has expressed concern to me in a number of these areas, particularly in regards to some of our discussions of late in terms of requiring the flexibility to use paper and pencil methodologies to our testing framework here. That may well be, but members, I would just note that this bill does not require paper and pencil. The bill is very clearly focused on a computerized administration. And so, Madam Chair, I think it certainly would be appropriate. I noticed in the packets that some information about the overall testing budget of the department. I think we should have a very healthy discussion about how the department uses those funds. It's a sizable appropriation that we make to the department in order to carry out its responsibilities relative to testing. Madam Chair, if you can indulge me perhaps a few more minutes, I would like to call Dr. Pakal up just to share, as a co-chair of the task force, a little bit more insight around the logic and I would say the beauty of the proposal that came forward from the task force.
Thank you, Representative Mariotti. I know that there's been a lot of work in this proposal, and we welcome Dr. Pakal. We have four other testifiers all to talk about the policy, and this is the Finance Committee, so we want to save the lion's share of our time for the fiscal note, because all the good policy in the world can die quickly in this committee if we don't understand the fiscal note. So all the people that are testifying on behalf of it, it's to everyone's advantage to get to the fiscal note. Dr. Pakal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be with you. My name is Kent Pakal. I head up the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. I'm a once and I think hopefully future K-12 teacher and administrator. Madam Chair, I'll be very brief because a number of you actually could probably recite what I'm about to say because you've heard me say it so many times. So let me just underscore the inclusive nature of the work that we tried to do in developing the proposals that Representative Mariani just described. Not in addition to the 20 people on the task force that worked between May and March of the past year, we received more than 250 comments over the web, some of them pages long, and we conducted in-depth focus groups and research in partnership with the Citizens League and six schools to really test out the premises of our system. So let me just give you four themes that undergird the policy behind this proposal, and then I'm glad to be helpful to you as you dig into the dollars and cents. They are One, focus on college and career readiness. Two, using multiple measures to assess student knowledge and skills. Three, creating tests that are useful for improving instruction. And four, creating multiple pathways of equal rigor to high school graduation. Let me say a very brief point on each of those, and Madam Chair, I think they do all have implications for your work on the Finance Committee. We recommended a comprehensive exam in language arts, which measures the knowledge and skills that kids learn over multiple years in school, because frankly, college and career-ready literacy is mastered in multiple courses over a fairly broad array of time. 10th grade also gives a number of years for students who don't meet the standard to catch up before they would not earn a diploma with their peers. We recommended an end-of-course test in algebra and biology. And for those of you who haven't had this discussion, that's different from a comprehensive exam, which is given at one point in time to measure skills that kids learn over multiple years. An end-of-course exam is like a final exam that most of you had in your high school or college courses. Its intent is to measure the learning in a course. And so we've recommended end-of-course exams in high school algebra and high school biology that would measure the critical content taught in those two courses, which are required for graduation already in Minnesota. We've said that, so moving on into the second theme, multiple measures. In particular there with biology and algebra, we've said, because standardized tests are not perfect measures of readiness for college and careers, we want to include other indicators of readiness. And so that end-of-course test in algebra and biology would count for 25% of the student's final grade in the course. The additional work that the student does in the course factors into the rest of the grade. The student has to pass the class to move on and meet state graduation requirements. As Representative Mariani suggested, because there's a concern that if you make passing the class one of the critical triggers for earning a high school diploma, there might be grade inflation pressure. And I can tell you, having been a high school teacher, that would be something I'd be concerned about. And so we've recommended the creation of something that really no other state has included in its high school accountability system, which is what we call an alignment index, which would essentially compare the test scores that students get to the final grades they get in those courses and take some steps to bring to bear what some on our task force started to call truth in transcripts, but really to get at the question of alignment between the tests our kids take to get into college or get out of high school and the grades they get as they move through school. Third theme, usefulness for instruction. We recommended, first of all, that the state should begin, as Representative Mariani suggested, to get into the business of providing the front-end assessments that predict student performance on the assessments that have stakes. Those are sometimes called formative, sometimes called diagnostic assessments. There actually are differences. But the big idea is that if we're going to ask our schools to intervene with kids who are not on track, we want to give them aligned measures of readiness early enough to make sure they're taking those steps and doing so effectively. We've recommended, in order, again, to be useful for instruction, we got to get that rate of return down, and we're hoping for 3 days. And that means, members, we recommended moving entirely to computer-based assessment. Having been responsible in St. Paul schools for both technology and assessment, which are separate entities, I'll tell you, there is a crossing the freeway issue here of capacity as we move from paper and pencil to computer-based. The task force was clear we need to get there, but I'll tell you, having been responsible for both getting the tests out and making sure the computers are working, there's a tension that I know you're mindful of as policymakers, as I know the department is, of do we cross that freeway one lane at a time, or do we make the jump, maybe get hit once as we go across. And finally, Madam Chair, we've recommended multiple pathways. That would be the fourth theme that I would suggest. And some states are literally creating lots of new tests. Texas is going to give 11 end-of-course tests. In our approach to multiple pathways, we did not recommend a plethora of new tests, but we recommended that Minnesota make it possible to complete your high school graduation requirements by also demonstrating college and career readiness on a number of tests that our Minnesota kids are already taking, such as advanced placement or international baccalaureate tests in the relevant subject, or on the ACT or SAT or CLEP. Well, I always forget that acronym, college entrance exams that already exist across the state. And so if a kid, because they're in PSEO or in another learning environment, doesn't take that algebra or biology course in their high school, or does but actually can demonstrate college readiness on another assessment, they would also be able, Madam Chair, to do so through that system. So again, the four big themes, a focus on college readiness, two, using multiple measures to assess and hold kids accountable for learning, three, tests that are actually useful at the classroom, school, and district level for improving teaching and learning, and fourth, multiple equally rigorous pathways to assess our students' readiness for life after high school.
Thank you, Dr. Pickell, for your fine work co-chairing this task force, and we'll be having Dr. Mattson up, who is your co-chair, when we get to more details of the fiscal note. So thank you very much. The next four people, Mr. Locklear and Ms. Dr. Casilius, if you two could come up right now. And then we will have Jim Bartholomew and Cecilia Rattel. And if you all could take like a minute to 2 minutes, and then we will get to the fiscal note with Dr. Mattson. So welcome. And Mr. Locklear, you are on the list first.
Thank you, ma'am.
And if you could restate your name and title for the tape.
Okay, gladly.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bruce Locklear, and I'm the principal of Edina High School, and it is a privilege to be here today to speak to you on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, a father of two students who are graduates of the Minnesota Public School System and doing quite well in college now, as well as an advocate for excellence. There are so many things happening in education right now, and I just want to take a couple of minutes to share some ideas around what some of those are, and especially 3421 and the implications on testing as far as our school is concerned. I will begin with my recommendations, and I will support my recommendations with some points that I would like to share as we move through this. I would certainly beg you to please consider delaying this bill until we can garner some ground rule support for this bill. There are so many implications for this bill that we do not completely understand. The second contention that we have as a school district, as well as a state, I was just at 2 days worth of meetings with principals from across the state. The 50% rule is of grave concern to us, and I'll demonstrate why in just a moment. The third thing is the transfer rule. We don't exactly understand what that means yet, and so if we can clarify what that is, that's great. And I would certainly urge everyone to please let's keep this an educational issue and not a political issue. I would like to begin with a day in the life of a high school principal. And I love my job. Last year I stood up before the junior class and said, okay, we have a high stakes test. No pass, no graduate. And as a school we did quite well on that test. We missed the passes rate by 0.1%. Our subgroup that did not pass was our black subgroup in math. And of that subgroup, half of the subgroup was comprised of Somali students who have no command of English. And so the illogic behind that just evades me. This year, I'll stand up and say, okay, we have a new state assessment. And this time, oh, we know, we have to pass. Not exactly. You'll have three times to take the assessment. And if you don't pass it, we'll pass you. And certainly I thank the committee for going back and understanding the changes in the law, and we appreciate that. And next year I'll stand up and say, okay, we have a new test. And it really puts us as educational leaders in a very precarious situation as we try to define the expectations that we're held accountable to. And it's very difficult for our students to understand that. And so I would certainly, again, beg indulgence in terms of garnering grassroots support. I had a teacher on the committee.
And I should say, I've said 1 to 2 minutes, and you've had almost four. So you're going to have to finish quickly. But if you're
okay.
Trying to kill the bill,
I was told I had 30
the
minutes.
Fiscal note, that might work, too.
All right. Well, I'll conclude again with just certainly begging the indulgence of the committee to look at postponing the vote on this bill and moving it back to a situation where we can garner the appropriate support.
Thank you very
much. And
I'll
stop there.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dr. Casilius.
Chair and members, again, I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you again. I've had the opportunity to testify. You know most of my opinions already. They've gone on record. I also want to commend Kent and...
Excuse me, if you could restate your name and title for the team.
Dr. Brenda Casilius. I'm with Associate Superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools. I want to thank the commissioner and Ken Pickell and Dirk on their leadership with this bill. I am a signatory on the bill and support the bill as it was written. There are six things that concern me, and I'll get right to the fiscal note on those six things. We just read in the Star Tribune our NAEP scores, and I talked to this body and Chair Mariani quite considerably about the racial impacts of this bill. And Commissioner was quoted in the paper talking about spending more money on minority students and really getting at this gap. And this is our persistent responsibility here at this body at this time. And we can only get at the gap if we give money to the inputs into the system rather than only focusing on the outputs. We've got to do something about what we are doing for our kids. So let me talk quickly about the six items that I'm worried about. One is misalignment. There is no research to support this new novel idea. We're very concerned about the misalignment here and how that could impact our students. I would, if we go toward misalignment, I would suggest that we decouple the end of course exams and the end of course credit that's given to students because of the false positive and false negatives that are given in standardized test scores. Also, I want to talk quickly about the 50% and the 25%. What this does is punish students for how students did beforehand. The students who came before had a 25%. Now students after that now have a higher standard at 50%. If we decouple it, that would take care of that. So we could go ahead and stick with the 50% if you want, but decouple that in terms of the course grade. Three, we have to address this as an early warning system in elementary school. We have to raise our standards in elementary school and have a college-ready benchmark at elementary, a true college-ready benchmark in elementary, so that students aren't told they're proficient in elementary, and then later in high school, when the bar raises to 75% norm reference to pass that exam, and earlier we've told them they are ready, and they really aren't ready. Four. Competing with other initiatives, we are raising the bar in all of our schools. We are raising advanced coursework, increased access, accelerated learning opportunities, and if students are constantly having to take remedial courses, that is going to cost us a lot of money and cost us in capacity with reteaching school. And then finally, I'd like to talk about what is our plan B? What are the financial impacts of this decision? What are our civic impacts to this decision? What are our policy impacts to this decision? Are we going to increase adult basic education? Are we going to move to a K-16 system? Or are we going to increase social services? Something has to happen with our students. Currently, Minneapolis is sitting with 671 seniors who still yet to have to pass the exam. 163 of those have to pass all three exams. 197 have to pass two exams. 311 have just one exam to pass. We have got to do something about what plan B is for these students if we pass this test. And so as we think about these stakes for our children, I want us to also think about the stakes and the true shared accountability that we have with systems, with principals, and with teachers. And I ask you to consider this bill and think about, are all these stakes on our students, or is it a true shared accountability? I think that these financial impacts are very great, and I'm asking you to reconsider. Thank you
very much, Dr. Casilius. Mr. Bartholomew and Ms. Rattel. Dr. Bartholomew. Or Mr. Bartholomew.
I should be so lucky. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and you should have a one-pager that I'll reference in my comments. As a member of the CCRPI Task Force, we do want to recognize all the time and hard work that's gone into bringing House File 3421 to you today. There are some positive aspects being proposed. However, we would strongly ask that you not support this proposal. At its heart, House File 3421 is an effort to revert back to a pass-the-course strategy for determining if high school students are adequately prepared to graduate. The problem with this approach in math and science is it opens the door to a wide variety of definitions of how good is good enough. And quite literally, these definitions can change from high school to high school. Inevitably, in such a system, some students will be better served than others, and the consequences for students are substantial. to quickly highlight the chart on the handout, and in the middle in particular, this shows the gap between what students needed to do to earn a high school diploma, the top line, and the number of students that went on to a Minnesota public post-secondary institution, either 2 or 4 years, within 2 years of graduating from high school, and needed remedial coursework in reading and math. These numbers are not atypical, and they show a statewide problem. Too many students are graduating without being adequately prepared. The numbers below the chart simply highlight how few students, the 27%, 1 in 4 ninth graders, how many students will not finish a post-secondary degree program, either 2 or 4 year. Going back to a pass-the-course strategy will not help identify common expectations for all students or foster some linkages with higher education. Finally, we do support the concept behind the alignment index, but we do have questions whether it'll have a strong enough impact to correct the anticipated concerns with grade inflation. And Madam Chair, specifically to the fiscal note, we'd just like to put a reminder in there that while the cost of statewide assessments is not insignificant, a way to put that into context is the cost for that is less than half of 1% of the total spending for K-12 education. For less than half a percent, you get some just indispensable performance information. So again, we very much appreciated the opportunity to participate on the task force and all the work that's gone into this legislation, but we would ask that you please don't adopt House File 3421.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Ms. Rattel.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cecilia Rattel from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And you should all have a packet that just got handed out with the Minnesota Chamber logo in the upper left corner. And there's two major, and you'll see that we have been working a lot with the author and the commissioner's office and members that were on the task force to try to add in some language that concerned us. And there's, so you'll see the center column is amendments that have been made, and the far right is the column that are things that we're still concerned about. But you've asked us to stick to the fiscal concerns, so I'm going to stick to the two things that we really think are not included in the fiscal note, but that will have a fiscal impact that also need to be addressed. And the first one is not having in place a track for students that will test into the lower two levels, which are considered on track for readiness or off track for readiness. Students that fall into those levels, you'll see on the third page that there's other states that are doing things that are working for these students to get them up to college and career ready. And plans like this could be put into place here to get students to that point, but we know they are going to have a fiscal impact, but they're not yet included in the language. So things like this we do think should be included in the language. And the other area that needs to be addressed is the appeals process, which I've also, that's the majority of the packet, it's the last 5 pages, I believe. And the provisions in the language only kind of lay out that somebody else will decide what this appeals process will look like, but it doesn't actually address what it will be. And it is kind of concerning that there's not even any appeal language necessary for the science or math section, because everyone passes that automatically because you don't have a required score there. So putting in an appeals process that's defined of what path they will take, we believe will also clarify that for students, teachers, anybody that's involved to know what the correct procedure would be. So included in that is the Massachusetts language, and I've underlined parts that we think are most important to clarify that language, but we also think should have been included in the language and should have been part of the fiscal note. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you so very much. And thank you to all the testifiers for being more concise than we probably would have liked you to be if we had more time. Dr. Mattson, we now have 10 minutes. And members, I consider this the beginning of the fiscal discussion should this bill end up in the omnibus bill, because obviously we do not have a fiscal target for this committee to spend money. So the only way to spend money is to take away from something else. And so we want to really understand the fiscal note, and we are aware that the testing budget, and welcome Commissioner Segrin as well, is a large budget. It's something like $15 million, and so we want to know how much can be absorbed and how much cannot, and that's reflected on our fiscal note here. So who would like to start? Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dirk Mattson for the department. The fiscal note that you have is based on the bill as introduced and does not reflect current changes that were made at the end of House policy passage. Essentially, in a nutshell, on page one, we anticipate, if you look to the total cost to the state, you know, in a soundbite, those are the costs that it takes to essentially run both assessment systems. As Representative Mariani mentioned, that is one of the concerns, is transitioning off of the GRAD and onto another system. Unless you completely shut down one system and then begin the next one, that one is an easier absorption, if you will. We can redirect those funds to the development, implementation, and administration of the new access system. But since we have to, or at least is as proposed, we would have to run the GRAD system and continue and maintain that. You actually see that spiking number of 1.4 in that year, because that is the year that we are doing field testing on algebra and the biology end, of course, and to some degree our, although that'll be an easier, a smoother transition, our reading and writing tests. So we've got a bundle of tests. There are more tests that would be happening that year. You see it trail off to 940 the following year, and we expect as the GRAD sunsets, just as we are planning to experience on the BST sunsetting, obviously less funds are being appropriated or directed toward that issue. So the costs, again, at the top, that is looking at the bill as introduced, expenditures, that is what we expect to see, 959. Again, these are, of course, as all fiscal notes are, estimates, 3.2 and 4.3. Money that is currently being used in the assessment budget for the MCA high school tests and the grads. Remember, we're not just talking about one test, but we've got several content areas there. Writing tests, etc. That's the number on the less agency can absorb. And again, that's not extra money sitting in the coffers. It's money that's being would be redirected. And then you do the delta, and you have that there. We've given you, as Representative Mariani mentioned, some cautions about current conversations about paper tests, and this continues to be. It certainly is more costly to retrofit back into a paper test, if that is the desire of policymakers, than to start out with that idea in mind. Just like building a house, it's easier to design from the beginning than to go back and retrofit. The expenditure costs are listed at the bottom of page two. That is our estimates according to those tests. Again, those do not reflect absorption dollars. This is just the cost of the program, and the redirected currently encumbered funds are reflected on page one. And then, as was introduced, it still does have phase two conversation and the long-term fiscal considerations, as well as some studies that are requested of the bill as well. And we've obviously noted, as has been made by other testifiers, the impact on computerized assessment to the local school districts.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson. Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair, Dr. Mattson has reflected, you know, kind of the transition and the building of new tests and the transitioning out of old. And I do want to correct some statements that I think the principal made before about, you know, telling his students that, you know, this year they're going to have to be doing end of course. This isn't going to be happening for a while. So, you know, the descriptor that you had where, you know, one year it was stakes and the next year it's now three strikes and then you can pass. Are now this next year he's going to be standing up and saying, now you've got end of course. End of course is not coming yet, so I want to make sure that we all understand that's not a something that a principal should be standing up and telling their students that now they're going to have end of course. That's not coming for, you know, several years. So we're not switching this. It's not like a light switch. We're not switching these systems on and off. So I just want to make sure, if you misunderstood that we're not doing this next year. This is, you know, down the road a piece. And as Dr. Mattson said, we are trying to, we are very committed to doing the interim or the benchmark assessments. We want to do that to the extent that we could, you know, try to scale up one. We would try to do that, try to absorb as much of the cost, but there's still going to be an over, you know, cost above what we can do. But we've tried to, and we will be getting a fiscal note to reflect. If we tried to do all four of the benchmark assessments, that would put us, you know, into a larger fiscal note. But we will get that to you. This is based kind of on the original, so but some costs were saved because we took out the rulemaking as we changed that, so that helped a little bit. So we will get you a fiscal note within a day or two of the reflection of the actual first engrossment, too. And then also wanted to lay on the table the, if you need to make a decision, and Representative Mariani and I have talked about that, about whether people still want to continue with paper pencil in a transition period, too, because we're already having requests by school districts asking if there's going to be a paper pencil option, and I think that you really need to have that discussion. The assumptions of the work group, and Representative Mariani was, very direct with me and said, no, we always assumed that it was going to be computerized, and we never had a discussion in a work group other than that, and so I think he's been very clear in that position. But as we came back this year, we've had requests for paper pencil, and so I want to lay that on the table for you all. If this is the direction, then you need to stick with it, and then if you come back in a couple of years and say, oh, we need paper pencil, that will be an additional cost to stand that back up again. So,
and the bill before us has no paper and pencil. And
it
what
does
we're
not.
We're interested in is, and it sounds like you are preparing a new fiscal note. Do you see that will be sizably cheaper? We've had people asking us to delay it when this is a year when we don't have new money. And so, unless we get the fiscal note down, I think the delaying becomes a stronger argument with a committee that has no new money.
Madam Chair, I will have Dr. Mattson, speak to the new fiscal note. Will reflect the four. In this fiscal note, we have, I'll let Dr. Mattson.
Dr. Mattson, and we do have 3 minutes left of the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll be brief. The fiscal note that's before you, as introduced, does reflect paper only. It reflects cautionary notes. I beg your pardon. I'm not helping to be brief. It reflects computer only. It does reflect cautionary notations about if you moved to paper at a later time. But this fiscal note is true to the bill as introduced, that it's computer only. We do expect those costs for the interim tests and the benchmark tests we anticipate adding roughly between $800,000 and $1 million per fiscal year once those are up. Again, we're doing four separate, essentially think of it as eight tests. We've got four interim assessments and four item banks that are in the bill at that point.
And I'm just reminded that clock is fast, so we actually have five more minutes. So, all right, are there questions from members? Representative Dietrich, and then Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question will be really quick. In regards to the technology piece of this, I know we've gone around and around. Then do we understand the state costs of computerized testing. Do we get a local impact statement then of what school districts will need to be putting forth in order to be prepared for this, the computer adaptive testing?
Right.
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, we do not have a local impact statement on that because it's going to be very completely by district by district. Some districts have more than enough technology. Some, and most of it, quite honestly, is not about T1 lines and all the rest. It's simply about students to computer ratio. Can you get enough students through the computer labs, et cetera? We do have site readiness certifications that we do with districts to make sure they're up and running. But we do not have, there have been survey after survey and committees also with members of the legislature serving on them about the capacity of districts for their technology. But we don't have information of District A versus District B as a 4-to-1 ratio versus a 3, et cetera.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, it's more probably a matter of whether a school district wants to dedicate their lab time to computerized testing. You remember the discussion a few years ago, we wanted to have fast turnaround time. So we all thought, yeah, we should go to computerized testing, that would save time. But then districts find out that, well, they still need to reserve their lab time to implement the testing, which right now takes about a week. And then if you throw in benchmark tests, which go on during the school year, three times, then you've got more lab space that's taken up. So you've got this dilemma of you know, using lab time for testing purposes, not just only the summative tests, but also the formative. So those are trade-offs that you have to think about. Now, at the end of course, if we move to end of course, those tests can be taken at different times during a student's career. So you might take Algebra 2 as a freshman, a sophomore, or a junior, so you're not, you know, in mass having kids take those tests at the same time, so, which will help relieve some of the pressure with computer time. But those are the trade-offs that you have. You have the unwieldy paper pencil, which takes a lot of time. You don't get results back. It's more costly because just the shipping, the printing, all the security versus the computer. So those are sort of the trade-offs that I think everybody needs to be aware of as we're moving. You can certainly save money by doing the computer tests, but there's the trade-offs.
Representative Abney, you get the last question.
Well, Madam Chair,
Time's up.
I think, Madam Chair, the hard part is that this is our last hearing.
Right.
And we're in 2000, I think it is, we spent $6 million on testing. Last year we spent $15 million, so a dramatic increase in costs. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bartholomew said we get all this great information. I don't see it. I think we've got a Cadillac testing system with increasing costs from what I see. We're not getting Cadillac value back, and we've got, I think, to work off of Representative Dietrich's point about the local impact. Districts are having to do the formative testing multiple times of the year because the state testing doesn't provide valuable information to students, teachers, and parents. And so if we marry the costs of the state testing and then the add-on testing that districts have to do as well to get educational value data, it ends up being a lot of money and a lot of coordination and a lot of burden and a lot of confusion. And I guess I'm not understanding what the cost drivers are. I'm not understanding a number of things that I think I would like to understand before we move forward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You guys can
give the answer. I can give a context to your question.
Siegert.
I think that's a very good question, Representative Dabney. In 2005, we administered 15 tests, and our budget was, or our cost for each child was about $1,000. In 2009, we administered 45 tests because, remember, in that interim, the federal government said that we had to go from tests that were only one in elementary, one in middle school, and one in high school to tests grade 3 through 8. Then we also had to do specialized tests for special education kids, so we had to develop what we call an MTAS test. We also tried to develop specialized tests for English language learners. So now we have 45 tests that we have to administer that we had to get up and running. But our cost per test has gone down to $619 per student. So we actually have created efficiencies in how we first administered tests to today. But it's because we also have a lot more tests that we have to give. That's why our testing budget has gone up. It hasn't been because we've created necessarily a Cadillac, although I will stand by our tests as being very high-quality tests. As Representative Dabney, you alluded to, because they're paper-pencil, they haven't been as helpful to our teachers, and that's been a frustration for all of us. But that is why there is the increase. It's just mainly because we've had more tests, but we've also had some efficiencies as we've scaled up. So we've tried to do both. We've tried to squeeze as much out of our system to be as efficient as possible, at the same time being mandated to create more tests.
And sorry, members, that we are out of time, and so the meeting is adjourned.